This is a Pinball News production.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Wally Grzowski, and like Rob said, this is a seminar about building a medieval madness from parts. I'm planning to be finished in about 30 minutes, and then I'll have time for questions. If you want us to go back to a slide, just keep make a note of the numbers are in the left-hand upper left-hand column, and just make a note of which ones you want us to go back to. My project began in the fall of 2010 and ended in January of this year. I have been reading posts on RGP about the possibility of building an MM. It seems like the topic would come up about every 6 months or so, and there were a lot of opinions like the total cost would be more than just buying one, or that just too many parts weren't available. But there were two guys in particular on RGP, Gary Martin and Eric Schmidt. These guys were pretty confident that it could be done, and even at a reasonable cost. They did have rough cost estimates, and they recommended converting another WPC 95 game. So I started by downloading the assembly drawings and parts list from the Internet Pinball Database. And for those of you that haven't gone onto that site, that is just an excellent resource for photos, drawings, manuals, and parts lists. The parts list for MM is 2,448 lines long, and there's over 20 assembly drawings available. This is the section of the parts list that details the catapult. Williams uses a 0.2 prefix to indicate major assemblies and uses higher prefixes to designate sub-assemblies, and every individual component right down to the exact rivets or screws required. It's really helpful when looking for parts because an assembly might not be available, but the components that make up an assembly could be available. Also, in most cases, it's less expensive to buy individual components and assemble them rather than to buy a completed assembly. I know this might be kind of hard to see, but you know, if you take the parts list, and I like drew a line whenever I came to a 0.2, which would indicate a major assembly. Drew a line there, and you scroll down. When you get to the next 0.2, I drew another line. That's the flipper coil, one of the flipper, not flipper coil, it's the flipper assembly. So between the two lines are all the components of the catapult. You could even look further down and see some of the sub-assemblies, like this one right here, solenoid plunger assembly. It has three components, the plunger, the flipper link, and a roll pin. So if this assembly isn't available, these three might in fact be available, and you can buy those and just put it together. Williams also uses a decimal point to indicate revisions. So if you see a 0.1, that's Rev 1. If you see 0.2, it's Rev 2, and so on. This is the assembly drawing for the catapult. I went through each of the lines on the list and found which vendor stacked which parts and which ones weren't available. At the beginning, I slowly bought some of the more rare ones, or the ones that only one vendor had in stack. There is a really neat parts cross-reference database link, and it's on Pinball Life and Bay Area Amusement site, and it's written by a fellow by the name of Øyvind Mall. I hope I have that pronounced right. And it's a wonderful program for cross-referencing parts between machines, and also if you want the total number of parts that you need for a machine, it'll give you the total number. It's a great resource. By the year end, I had either located or purchased the majority of all those parts. I bought an MM because I came to the conclusion early on that I couldn't build one without having one nearby. I needed to measure parts that weren't available, such as the ball guides and wire ramps, and an MM would also be valuable in building the wire harnesses and putting together some of the more complicated assemblies. So the plan kind of evolved into buying and restoring an MM, selling it, using the old parts, handmade parts, and donor parts, build a player replica pin to keep. And that's the one that I have here. It's a player replica pin with all my homemade stuff in it. The plan worked out pretty good, and it had extra benefits like, you know, having an MM available to play and having that MM also to test assemblies as I completed them. I would usually only work a couple hours a day, some days or weeks, not at all. I did usually a lot of research before beginning most tasks, and I didn't mind redoing something if it wasn't right. I really didn't have a schedule to meet, so I took my time, and I thoroughly enjoyed all the aspects. During the winter, I completed all the assemblies. I made unavailable wire gates by bending piano wire. And in this this slide over here, this is the guide, but the ball guide behind the castle. And the MM that I bought didn't even have this wire gate on it. But you can get fairly good pretty quick at bending these out of piano wire, you know, just by holding them with like vice grips and bending them with needle nose for those of you that are in need of one and can't do it. It's fairly simple to do. I also made the hex posts that weren't available. 1/4 inch and 3/8 inch hex stack was purchased from McMaster Carr. I cut these to the proper length. I drilled each end so that I could tap and add threaded sections where needed. The hex posts are shown here with my homemade ones on top and the originals on the bottom. I also used a drill setup like a lathe and a Dremel to make the shafts for the drawbridge gearbox that are also not available. The small cutoff wheel makes perfect grooves for the Eclipse. I just had the drill set up, and I used a magnifying glass, used a Dremel, and it cuts really nice Eclipse grooves. This is the next slide. He has the three that I made on the bottom and the original up on the top. I bought a routed NBA fast break, which is another WPC95 pin. Parts that were used included some hard-to-find ones like the speaker panel, cab harness, power transformer, back box, light insert panel or tub, and just a lot of other parts like the coin door, slings, jet bumpers, ball trough, auto launch, and flippers, not to mention the complete board set, cab, and head. The only difference you'll see is that on my MM there's a Bally speaker panel, and that's the one that they came from the fast break instead of the, it should be a Williams one. I removed all the ball guides and other ball deflectors from the MM, measured each with a micrometer and tape, and made sketches. I didn't straighten or alter any of the original guides. I wanted to maintain all those originals in the same shape that I got them. It's necessary to measure inside dimensions, you know, when you're measuring ball guides, because as you bend metal, the outer edge stretches. So you really have to measure the inside dimensions. My daughter-in-law, Annette, that's Walt's wife, is proficient in CAD, and she put them into files for me. I originally wanted the guides water or laser cut, but I settled on plasma. My neighbor's son, Scott, works in a shop where they have a plasma cutter, and he was able to just cut them for me. There's 22 individual parts that needed to be cut, which included the 15 ball guides. The plasma cut edges were pretty rough, and they all had to be ground, and I had to re-drill all the holes. The plasma didn't cut. It's not a very clean cut for the holes, so I had to re-drill all those. These are the parts after graining with 220 sandpaper and Scotch-Brite pads. All of those were cut from 18-gauge stainless. Each metal part needed to be bent. I used an 18-inch brake purchased at Harbor Freight. I should probably be a Harbor Freight salesman because I really love their tools. I mean, if you're going to use them once or twice, I mean, they're the greatest thing. You know, if you're going to do this every day, definitely not. But, man, I bought that $10 heat gun, and I've used it on a couple games already, taken off side art for $10. Man, you just can't beat it. Some were more complicated than others. For like this guide over here, I had to make a paper pattern to to determine the bending sequence so that it could subsequently fit into the breaker device. If I made the bends out of order, it wouldn't fit into the device to make the next one. Anyways, this is the first bend made with the brake and the completed bend. And this is the second bend, also made with the brake and the completed bend. And where threaded posts were needed, I drilled and tapped the stainless for a number 8 large diameter, low profile truss head screw. The stainless actually provides a really strong fit with only a few engaging threads. And I was a little surprised at this, but I could thread this 18 gauge stainless, and I couldn't, after putting a stainless screw in there, I couldn't strip it. As much as I, put a little oomph on it, they really hold tight. This is a small vise that I used from Home Depot to bend some tabs. And it's really kind of a neat little vise because it has really square faces that are not serrated so that it won't mar the finish. And then I bent over tabs using a small 3/8 inch bar stack and just tapping over the tabs with a plastic-faced hammer. Martin, I was talking to Martin before the thing. He says, was that your profession, sheet metal? I said, no, I never did this before in my life. I just got these things and took my time and just did it. This is the guide behind the castle. It's also one of the more difficult ones. There's the original on the bottom, and there's my rough piece on top. And this is making the first bend. And then I made the radiuses by my brother-in-law Ron had this piece of round stack brass at his house, and I used it with that plastic face hammer just tapping it, and you could make this stainless is wonderful to work with. I mean, it bends so nice, and it doesn't yield, and it's just really nice to make parts with. So I formed the radius with that round stack and bent over the tabs with. There's a 3/8 bar stack on top that I used to bend over the tabs. And some tabs I couldn't fit back into the vise again, so I had to improvise and bend them a little differently. And here it is nearing completion. I have one more bend to make on it. And this is making that final bend. And then tapping the hole for the number 8 screw. And there's the finished product. Mine is... The one that I made is on the top, and the original is on the bottom. The next series of photos shows a sequence to bend the diverter on the right plastic ramp. I again used the brass round stack to form the radius. Next, the guide was clamped into the brake, and the first bend was made. Then the second bend was made next. The holes were tapped. And this is a photo of the diverter and the playfield. This is another guide that required determining the sequence of the bends. This is the first bend. And this is the second bend. Second bend. And this is the third bend. And bent up. And this is the last bend right there. The original is on the bottom. And the one that I made is on the top. Some of the guides required using bolts or scraps or little pieces of angle that I had laying around the house. This Harbor Freight brake also makes a good workbench to clamp things on. It's kind of neat. This one here, I just had to use a bolt to start making this bend, and the hammer to kind of hammer it over the bolt. And this is getting nearly finished. This is another guide where I was using a little piece of angle to bend over and make a bend here and completing the bend. And there's the original on the right, and I have the one bend made on the one on the left. And this is making the final bend and using that same piece of angle again. And there's my finished one on the top You know, the original on the bottom, I think. Other guides, the big ball guide, the large ball guide around the back of the play field. I had to bend that one on the play field itself. It just wouldn't fit into anything, and I just kind of formed that right on the play field. Other guides in brackets were much easier, just requiring one or two simple bends. Like this one just required the little tab to be bent, and this one just required one simple bend in the tabs. And this is by the castle, that's just one little bend. And this is an opto bracket, that just required the one bend. And this is another guide that just required a couple simple bends. And this one also required just a little simple bend. And there's a completed one in the original. These are some photos of the of my homemade guides and the play field. This is on the left of the play field, upper left. And, you know, again on the upper left near the catapult. And this is on the right side, shooter lane guide. And that's upper right after the shooter lane. And this is in front of the castle on the right. I also needed to make four of the wire form ball guides that weren't available. Mine are slightly longer. They extend flush with the bottom of the play field. I used a larger vise and an eighth-inch rod. This is one of the original ones over here, guys. And I was having a hard time making these knurled ends on the end of the wire forms. So I just made mine longer. I thought that if I made it flush with the bottom of the play field, I could always put a screw or something on the bottom to, you know, hold it, you know, from going through. But the way it worked out, it's a pretty tight fit, and I didn't need to do any of that. So mine are just longer, and they, like I said, they're flush with the bottom of the play field. During the summer, I worked on converting the NBA head and cabinet. It took most of the summer because it was a first for me. The cab needed slight modifications, like a hole for the launch button, filling in an area near the lockdown bar, and removing some of the cabinet wood so that the castle would clear. There's really a lot of good information on RGP, Pinside, and YouTube concerning cab restoration and side art decal replacement. But basically, I removed all the existing art with a heat gun and scraper. Any remaining adhesive was removed with orange powder. Then I painted, bondoed, and sanded until I got a smooth finish. I used the Bosch random orbital sander, you know, starting with 80 grit, moving to 150, and then finishing up with 220. I used Painter's Touch spray paint exclusively, sanding light between coats. My brother-in-law, Ron, gave me a hand with the bondo and the paint. I was having a hard time with some of the, I didn't have the touch like he did, and so he gave me a hand with that. I used the wet method for decal replacement, and I used the Rapid Tack wetting solution. Edges were trimmed with a utility blade, and then black paint pen was used to run across the entire length. My wife Janice gave me a hand with the decals. I know you guys are probably wondering, what did I do? You know, I got all these guys helping me. But my wife, I showed her the YouTube video of this fellow by the name of Metahue, who was replacing the side art on his Indiana Jones. And I said, do you think you're able to do that? And she looked at the video for like 2 minutes. She had done a lot of wallpapering. She looked at the video for 2 minutes. She says, I could do that. That's no problem. So a couple days later, boom, we had all the artwork in. I reused the ground braid. I cleaned it all with bleach white. And if you have good lighting, you can actually put the ground braid right back in where it came from, right back where it originally was. You could see the staple holes, and you could use them as a guide. And the ground braid, of course, is in the same position on MM as it is on the MBA. Wood parts that had to be made included the right side rail, the back panel, and the skid runners in the back. I used pine for the backboard, poplar for the side rails, and oak for the back runners. I originally made the side rail from oak. And, you know, I really didn't like the way it looked. You know, oak has got that really pronounced grain in it. And so I made it out of poplar, and I really liked the way that looked better. The backboard required a decal, and these are some of the assembly photos. And that's the completed backboard. These are some of the photos showing attaching the side rail and the back panel to the playfield. I reused the apron from the NBA. I removed the NBA decals with Goof Off, repainted and applied new decals. I also reused the insert panel or the tub from the NBA. I scraped the thick decal off. I made a template from a paper template from the original MM. And then I drilled pilot holes and finally cut the larger holes in the NBA panel so that the lamps would be in the same position as the original MM. Then additional IDC lamp sockets were installed with new wiring. There were six major wiring harnesses to build. The solenoid, the switch, feature lamp, GI, opto, and back box. The original Williams design has the feature lamp and the GI together, but it was a lot easier for me to separate the two and make them separate. Sections of all the NBA harnesses were modified to work in the MM. Additional wire was added where needed and color matched to match the original with a wire scraping tool that my son Walt made. And Walt is running the video here. But I think it's kind of clever. It's a paint pen. You had a 90-degree angle, and you run the wire through and put a stripe on it. My granddaughter painted it. I wanted to make the wiring code exactly the same as the Williams, because a while back I had been talking to I'm in the Frankfurt Car Club. And one of the gearheads over there, we were talking about kit cars one day, and he says, "Hey, Wally, you ought to see it." He says, "Guys build these kit cars, and they spend years putting it together. When they get to the very end where they need to wire it, they go out and buy a big roll of yellow wire, and they wire the whole car in yellow wiring." He says, "Then when it comes time to troubleshoot," he said, "it is a bear trying to figure out what's going to what and what's going to where." I should probably mention, too, that the wiring that I used on the play field itself, I wanted that to look kind of good because this wire striping jig does not put a spiral, and I wanted to get to make it look like closer to original. I used the wiring from Bay Area Amusements. They carry all the different colors of wire with the proper stripe on it. The wires were spliced to the NBA harness by soldering and applying two layers of heat shrink tubing. I was a little bit paranoid about maybe a little strand or something like that hanging out of one of my splices and shorting or whatever. So I overkilled it with, I put on one layer of heat shrink tubing, and then I rolled another layer of heat shrink tubing over it and put that one in. I started with the solenoid harness. This harness is made from 18-gauge wire. Each solenoid or flasher has a single continuous wire going back to the driver board connector. I shortened the NBA harness by about a foot so that only one wire needed to be lengthened. I almost used all the wire off the solenoid harness from the NBA and this MM. There's plenty of extra wire on the NBA harness. It almost appears as if the play field was designed to be removed from the machine while still connected and connected to the boards. The next steps that I took to make the solenoid harness was to first cut off all the playfield connectors from the NBA. Next, I draped the NBA harness over the MM, shortened by a foot. And I used the Velcro strips along with clamps in the very top of this photo to hold the harness in place. So this is the original MM over here. And I just draped the NBA harness and clamped it up here and tied it up with Velcro or clothespins or whatever I could find so that it was right on top of the original. And then the next, I cut the single return wires and the NBA so that they met up with a specific solenoid or flashers and the MM. Some additional flasher wire was needed because there's some of the flashers are wired in parallel on the MM. Then I removed the harness from the MM and installed all the Molex connectors. Finally, I daisy-chained power wires per the schematic. Each of the four power circuits feeds between 3 and 7 solenoids. In order to connect the two wires to a single pin, I used the procedure outlined on Clay's site. I'm sure you guys have been on pinrepair.com. And he's got a nice section on there about pinball connector information. And it involves stripping the wires slightly longer, soldering them together before crimping in the Molex. After crimping, the pin is slightly heated to melt the solder. For single wire connections, I just crimped, no solder, like Molex recommends. Molex doesn't really recommend you doing any soldering under connectors, but when you have two wires, it's really tough to do without. The Opto harness involved modifying the NBA harness by lengthening each wire to the ball trough and adding new wire for the 3 MM-specific Aptos. I routed part of the harness a little bit differently so that the wiring wouldn't cross over the 10 Apto board. So instead of wires going across the Apto board, I have wires going to the left and right of the Apto board. The WPC95 connectors at the driver board maintain the same color code for NBA and for MM. So I didn't have to change any wiring at the driver board connectors, with the exception of one wire at J109. I built a wiring fixture to simplify the construction of the GI, switch, and feature lamp harnesses. And this is it right here. Walt also has it in the photo. And it's basically a mock-up of the back of the playfield on half-inch plywood. The GI harness, which has 3 individual circuits, was made by mounting all the sockets on the fixture and then using the MM as a guide, install the appropriate color 18-gauge and 22-gauge wire. My route is slightly different from the original, but all the GI lamps are in the same circuit with the same gauge wire as the original. Cable brackets, Velcro strips, clothespins, anything else I could think of help hold the harness in the correct shape while new wires were added. I didn't take apart any of the original harnesses. I was really kind of concerned that I wouldn't get them looking back the way they were. So I really didn't take any apart. This is the completed GI harness up against the original. The feature in switch harness, or feature lamp and switch harness, was built with the same fixture. Each socket, switch, lamp board, and opto board connector was identified on the fixture with its corresponding wire color. The feature lamps and switches, like everyone knows, is wired into 8x8 matrices. And this essentially means that there are 16 lamp and 16 switch wires that leave the CPU and driver boards and connect to all lamps and switches with quite a bit of daisy chaining. I would take one wire at a time, route it, color stripe it, and then splice it to the NBA harness. As an example, this is one of the 32 wires and how it was connected. The red wire with the orange tracer is daisy chained to 7 connectors or lamp sockets. The lamp location chart and a visual check of the connector were used to determine the location of the lamp boards and the sockets for that wire. Next, a route was developed to connect all in order to minimize wire length. Now, on this one here, you know, I just drew each one out, and I thought that if this one came up like this and went up here and hit this board first and then went to this lamp socket, came down here, hit these two lamp boards, and then ended up finishing up those two lamp boards, it would kind of minimize the amount of wire that I had. I didn't want to really make a lot of splices in that. I had enough splices, so I was trying to, you know, route the wire just like Williams routed it. Then the wire was color striped, installed per the route, and spliced to the NBA harness. harness. These are the photos of the feature lamp and switch harness coming together. Each harness took about 2 weeks to complete, working a couple hours a day. There's a feature lamp harness, a close-up of a feature lamp, another feature lamp, switch. I use a lot more cable ties than Williams. Switch harness. And that's the completed switch harness. One of the IDC connectors. These are some of the tools that I used. Really came in handy. Those wire strippers up in the upper left, man, those are really handy when you're doing a lot of wiring. They automatically strip off that little piece. And then, of course, the two Molex crimpers from Great Plains Electronics and Molex pin extractors. And that IDC punch-down tool is really cool. That's from Pinball Life. That's to punch the wires into the IDC connectors. IDC connectors are kind of neat because you can kind of route the wire through the IDC connector, and it clips into the top of it, so you can adjust it. You know, while you're building the harness, if you need a little bit more or a little bit less, you can adjust it. Once you got everything in position, you punch them all down, and then they're permanently on the IDC connector. I did a lot of testing before actually putting the harnesses on the pin. The feature lamp harness was tested using a 6-volt battery to power the lamps. I would just touch the different connectors in the matrix and make sure the lamp would come in. I would check continuity and check for shorts between wires. The final checks I made were by, of course, attaching the connectors to the boards and testing the individual sockets and switches. The wire ramps or habit trails were the last parts that were made. I had found an NOS center peasant ramp, but not the other two. I had been looking for those ramps for over a year with no success. And I was at the point where I was starting to practicing bending the eighth inch rod, you know, to form the habit trails. When I came across a sculptor in California through an internet search, actually he's a very talented, they call him rolling ball sculptures. And I don't know if you all have ever seen that, but you know, like takes a marble up to the top and they spin around and end up on the bottom. I guess he makes these things. He's an artist. So I sent him some photos of the ramps, of the habit trails, and he was confident that he could duplicate them. These are some of the photos of the ramps in his shop. And he made the right wire ramp very close. The original is on the top of this photo. His name is Matt Galden, and he resides in the Bay Area of California. I have his name in case you guys want to do it. You can check out the ramps on the machine. He TIG welds with stainless, so they look a little bit different than the originals, but they look pretty cool, I think. I was even thinking about getting them plated, but I like the way the stainless looks, and I think I'm just going to leave them like that. I had to send the catapult ramp back. He made a couple artistic changes on it. It wouldn't work right, so I sent that one back. He fixed it up and shot it back. These are some of the photos of the completed pins. I have all the photos used in my presentation available on my SkyDrive account, which is available through PinSide. If you just search under, there's one more MM. I have my thing in there, and I have a link to my SkyDrive with all these photos that I used today, plus some additional ones. Wrapping up, I wanted to talk a little bit about costs. And I do this with a little bit of hesitation because, you know, I really didn't build this MM to save money, primarily to save money. I did it really for the challenge and for, you know, a little bit of satisfaction you get, you know, when you finish something. And I really enjoyed every part of the project, from deciphering the Williams parts list to searching for parts to figuring out how to build parts, harnesses, to soldering, to bending the polishing stainless, to the woodwork, painting and applying decals. If I factored in my time, the total would be out of sight. You know, I probably have 1,000 hours invested. And my wife says more. She didn't see me for a while, you know, but it's just a lot of time and some patience. With all that said, I still believe that it's possible to build a really nice replica for under $7,000 in parts. And it would look a lot nicer than the one that I have here, because every part in the play field would be essentially new, with the exception of the ball guides and the habit trails, of course, which have to be handmade. But other new parts would be the translite sight art, the lockdown bar. The only used parts would be from the donor pin, like the power transformer and so forth. My replica cost less because it uses the old parts from the one that I restored. So I took all the old stuff and put it on here. And I have to wrap up by saying that a big thanks go out to all the vendors who make all these parts available. It's really tough making parts, And I would rather buy a part for $20. You look at it and say, holy cow, is that? I'd rather do that than try to make it. It's really, sometimes really tough doing that stuff. And thanks to those that go out and re-engineer and remanufacture new parts like play fields and things like that. Those guys, you wouldn't be able to do it if those guys weren't around. Also, a big thanks to all those people who post restoration tips and pictures and ideas in our RGP and Pinside and PinWiki and YouTube and Clay's DVDs, Brian Kelly's gallery of restoration tips. Thanks to all those guys. There's a lot of guys. There's a lot of guys who restore pinball machines, but the, in my opinion, the really great ones are the ones. The really great guys out there are the ones that take the time to make a tutorial or to make a video or to submit something on PinWiki or submit how they did something, and very specifically the paper that they used and everything else. Those are the great people, I think, in this hobby. Thank you. Any questions? Back there.
So with the beautiful support you put in bronze, do you have to do anything else to get it closer?
Okay. The question is if what else I had to do with the printed circuit boards. The RAM chips had to be replaced. There's five RAM chips, five sound RAM chips. The game chip has to be replaced. There is a security chip in the WPC 95 games that has to be replaced also. So those are all the chips. No wiring changes, just chip changes. The security chip is important because Williams and these later games, they put this security chip in there to, it was for something in Europe where they didn't want to have people taking games and bring them somewhere else. I don't know the whole story. Anyways, there's a security chip that has to be replaced too. Yes?
Given what you know now, are there any tools that you wish you had bought?
Given what I know now, any tools that I wish I would have had? I think there's a little bit, I think there's a different type of brake that has maybe a pointed section that'll actually collapse the piece on top. I think that might have came in handy. Other tools, I sprayed this all with rattle cans. I thought I was going to eliminate a lot of problems by not having to mess around with air pressures and solvents and thinning and all that stuff like that. But the rattle cans were pretty tough to paint with. There is another tool that I forgot about. If anybody does spray with rattle cans, it's the best $2 that I ever spent. It clips onto the top of a rattle can. It turns it into a pistol grip. It's the best $2 I ever spent. I mean, it's almost like spraying with a spray can or with a spray gun. That's a really neat tool. But no other tools that I can think of. Anything else? Yes?
We just found this blind dog tonight. If you make your daughter learn to, you know you can deal with her slowing down. That would have been fun if you're not.
No. There's a lot of things that, you know, as carefully as I would measure something and as precisely as that I thought that I could get it, there were some things that just wouldn't fit right. Some of the ball guys had to elongate some of the holes where they were attached. There were, nothing fits exactly right, it seems like. I would adjust the parts. I really wanted to bring that back. I really wanted those dimensions and everything to be as close to original as possible. However, Martin over here was playing the game before y'all came in, and he said, "Hey, you made that catapult shot a little bit tougher." I said, "Yeah, when I bent that guide, I made it a little bit longer than what it should be by mistake." And I just didn't, at that point, I just didn't feel like getting it recut and everything. So it's a little tougher shot to get it into the catapult. Anything else? Yes, I'm sorry.
Do you think you improved on anything in the minor detail, like, say, the saucer shot, which on some games that colleges do will not take a shot, like that?
Well, and the question is, do I think I improved on anything? Well, the saucer shot is kind of a rough shot. I had a little piece of that dead foam rubber in there, but it fell off somewhere in transport, so it's not even there anymore. But I did bend that, on that saucer shot, there's a guide behind the saucer, and if you bend it a little bit, you can maybe like less than a quarter of an inch, it makes that shot a little bit easier. Also, I noticed on my game, on the original, if two balls would go into the catapult, it would have a hard time shooting two balls out. My artist buddy that made the catapult, I don't know what he did on it, but it'll shoot three balls out. So, and I think some of the other guys were saying that the radius on the catapult has to be perfect to shoot two balls out. You're going to kind of bend that stuff around. But my artist buddy, I can shoot three balls in there. They fly out. Any other questions? Yes.
What's the next game?
I'd really like to make a Cactus Canyon from parts. The play field's been a stopper for me, and if anyone's got any leads on one, let me know. I'd really like to do that. And I may one of these days. Some of my pinball buddies from Pinball Mafia, they asked me what my next project was going to be, and I said, I'm thinking about converting an Attack from Mars into a Popeye. And one of the guys had a Popeye, and he says, I take a little bit of offense to that. I said, okay, Gilligan's Island. Another guy, I got to get... So anyways, that was just a little pinball joke. Anything else? Ren, that's my brother-in-law, the guy to help me with the painting.
Do you have any free t-shirts?
no free t-shirts. But I knew that was, I kind of figured that was coming. Anything else, guys? Yes?
You said you tested the shorts as you were running the water. When this game is completed and you turned it on, what sort of maintenance issues did you have? Or did it run perfectly
right away? It ran surprisingly well. I had to make some switch adjustments, by bending or whatever, but I was kind of meticulous and maybe a little bit nerdy going through all the wiring, and I was making sure that it was spot on, and the first time I plugged it in, it fired right up. So switch adjustments. You know what the most problem I had with the RAM chips? I had RAM chips burned, and I had a problem with the S2 RAM chip that was burned. And I put it in, and I fired up the machine, and I got first I got the two bungs indicating the sound chip. So I took it out, I put the original back in, everything worked. I had another S2 sound chip burned, put it in. Then I was showing my son Walt something about how not to short things out when you're working at it, always power down, and the chances of getting high voltage into the switch matrix is there, and you can do some bad things on the CPU board. And I was showing them all this with the game off, and I fired it back up again, and I got a 10 bong, which indicates another soundboard RAM chip error. And I said, what the hell's going on here? So I took the S2 sound chip out of the original and plugged it back in, and it fired right up. So that S2 sound chip that I had burnt, I must have went through three or four of those before I found the proper, before we were able to get that figured out on the machine. That one took a couple months. Anything else? Thanks. You know, Rob, if what I was thinking about doing, and I don't know what you think, I was thinking about after, before the next presentation, if I can get some guys to carry it out in the hall. I was thinking about just having it in the hall, and I would open it up, and if anybody wants to see inside, in any of the wiring or anything like that, I would just leave it out in the hall over here for several hours. Don't miss any presentations that you want to. I'll be out there in the hall with it, okay?
Another question I had. There was a rumor going around this game was built in the Make-A-Wish box.
Yeah, that was kind of a rumor. Were you talking to my brother-in-law? Our next-door neighbor over there? Thanks, everybody.